Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
I heard George R. R. Martin say one time in an interview, you know, he's the writer of Game of Thrones, the pulp book series. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you're going to, because he used to be a filmmaker too, film writer too. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you're going to adapt something, you don't pretend like you know better than the original writer about your story. You know, if you're going to make a Spider-Man movie, don't act like you know better than Stan Lee. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to play into what has already been established. And so I thought mm-hmm. Zack Snyder thought he could do something that no story had ever done before.
And what was that practically in terms of the movie itself?
Well, as far as the whole new idea of, you know, what Superman's powers actually are and the world he came from and the whole origin story and General Zod and what he was after and the whole, I mean, it was just, it was neat to kind of put a fresh spin on it, but to act like it was the, you know, was better than the original story. Zack Snyder just kind of has this, like, I'm a really good filmmaker way about him, because his last three movies have been awful. Like, Man of Steel, Watchmen, and then he made an original movie, which was, what was it called?
Sucker Punch.
Terrible. They're all terrible. They're visually really cool. Hmm. They're all terrible. And he, when he made 300, he stuck, I mean, almost page for page to the comic book. And that's why it was so good, because he's really good at the visual part of it, not the story side of it.
Interesting.
So they changed almost everything about Superman.
Hmm.
I mean, down to the suit. The suit was like the S. It was not an S. I mean, come on. E. You know?
So that's not part of the original story for it to be an E?
No, it's a symbol of hope or whatever, symbol of his family.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. That's an S, because he's Superman.
So, that's funny. Is that what it was, an E? What did it stand for?
What, it stood for hope?
It just
when they asked. It was their family crest.
Family crest.
That's why everybody had, like, something on. Yeah. It was just all different.
Then the action was just
overblown.
Mind-numbing. Yeah. Dumb.
So
never, which is fine. I love overblown mind-numbing action if it has a point to it. And none of it has a point. It was just to like make a big budget movie. I thought
you need pointful mind-numbing action.
Pretty much.
Well,
unless its point is to be mind-numbing, like the Expendables.
Like the Expendables. The Expendables gets a pass
because it's just like, this is all completely ridiculous, and they know it's completely ridiculous, and that's why they're doing it.
Which was why I didn't really like the first one that much, because
they weren't too seriously.
They took themselves a little too seriously.
And then the second one was just like zaniness.
The second one was full of one-liners and bad acting and over-the-top
heads
violence.
Blowing up from a pistol.
Seeing Expendables 2. There you go. There's one of those reviews we'll get to one day. People are like, surely there's nothing. No themes in Expendables 2, and I will say, there is.
Totally
not much, but there is. And then I'll make Elijah come on that one, too.
Sucking nectar out of the tree.
Yeah.
Tree bark.
Is everybody good? Are you good?
Yeah.
I'm totally good.
Good? All right.
Are you recording?
I've been recording for a long
time. Man,
we just got our, like...
You sneak in on that recording.
We got our second version of Man of Steel.
We got the whole thing?
Yeah.
Awesome.
We'll see if it makes the podcast. But anyway, for everyone else just catching up, welcome to Real World Theology. This is episode 7, and I am your host, Fizz. This week on the show, we are going to tackle Elysium, a film that has garnered a lot of controversy because of its themes and apparent moral conflicts with themes of self-preservation to self-sacrifice and a glorious world above the earth. The film is seeping with topics, so to help me rip the film apart, we have the return of Elijah, community pastor at Church of the Redeemer in Greensboro, and writer, podcaster, and screenwriter, Mark Wingerter. So what's up, gentlemen?
Good. Hanging out. Ready to talk some movies.
Ready to talk some movies?
Let's do it.
We have a lot to cover, so we can get kind of right into the beginning stuff. So, Elysium. Elysium is a film by Neil Blomkamp, set in the year 2154, where the very wealthy live on a man-made space station while the rest of the population resides on a ruined Earth. A man takes on a mission that could bring equality to the polarized worlds. So from socialized medicine to self-sacrifice, this film has stirred an incredible amount of controversy among moviegoers. So we're going to try to talk about the implications of polarized politics in movies and then deal with some of the themes that are a little more prevalent, I think, actually in the movie that are probably more worth talking about than the actual hype surrounding the movie.
Right.
So as usual, we're going to start out with just how we enjoyed the film. I enjoyed visually the film. Mm-hmm. I didn't really feel a connection to the film like I did with District 9, and there's lots of comparisons because Neil Blomkamp is the director who did District 9, very big hit, you know, Academy Award nominated best film. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to make this very, you know, people were very excited about this movie. Mm-hmm. And by all accounts, it was a letdown.
Yep.
For those people who were excited. And I can see why. He still did create a world that was visually engaging and a story that I could follow, though didn't really answer a lot of questions. So for me, it was kind of like a meh.
Mm-hmm.
But I know Mark was basically talking about this film all year.
Mm-hmm.
This was his golden goose. Mm-hmm. You know, so Mark, how disappointed are you?
I was looking forward to this movie all summer. Well, it's one of those that, like, you know, you start to see the so-and-so's making a movie with so-and-so and you're going, oh man, you know, it's like Blomkamp's got a new movie coming, and oh, and Matt Damon's now attached to star, and like followed like all the news articles of like the making of it, and then it came right. So I mean, I do that with, like, you know, Christopher Nolan movies like Inception. I did that with that, but with this one, I was really looking forward to it because I love District 9. I love sci-fi that is tries to have some kind of realism to it and to say something. So, I mean, you knew this movie was going to try to say something because District 9 did. So I was really excited about it. And I wasn't necessarily let down by the premise, and I wasn't necessarily let down by the visuals, because the visuals were great. As much as I disliked the movie, I wanted to go see it again just because of the massive visuals that they have. I was really let down by the filmmaking, which completely surprised me, because as how well District 9 was done.
What did you see between the two films? Like, what was the difference?
Story. I mean, District 9 was all about character and story and, you know, very personal, versus this one was trying to be a lot bigger, but it just completely ignored story and completely ignored character and threw in some very cardboard cutout characters and very basic story that they just kind of, you know, didn't think much about the implications of how a simple story was like kind of cheating the broad big visuals that they were creating. So, you know, we read a lot of articles like we always do leading up to this, and one of them was talking about how brilliant of a stage they created, and I kind of formulated this like, it's kind of like If you had a Broadway production caliber stage that was created, and then you took like felt board characters and told a story on it. I mean, it was completely surprising to me how simple the story was and how just, you know, how rushed it was. It was very rushed. It was an hour and a half movie that I felt could have been like 2 hours, 2 hours and 20 minutes. I mean, you think how long Blade Runner was, mm-hmm. even especially the director's cut of Blade Runner. I mean, it's just, it, you know, because it takes time to immerse yourself into a science fiction world because you're creating it from scratch a lot of the time. And they just,
I don't think the
script was just terrible.
Yeah. I don't think the director's cut of Blade Runner's ended yet. I think it's still,
yeah, I think it's still, still, I think showing it's still somewhere running, in a theater. just completely disappointed with how little approach was taken to the story itself, but impressed with the visuals. So I wasn't completely not entertained. I was happy to have seen it in the theater, So I was really entertained by it, and I didn't completely hate it. I was just disappointed, especially because how big of a buildup I had for it.
Yeah, that's always the danger. I think we actually talked about that a little bit last week on the show, too.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I first would make a general observation that I've seen a lot of movies come out this summer that have been kind of these two world movies, usually a separation of Earth and some other world. So you got After Earth, Will Smith, Tom Cruise did it.
Wait, did you see After Earth?
I saw After Earth.
You were the person that saw After Earth?
I was the first person that saw After Earth. What was Tom Cruise's? He did another world.
Oblivion.
So that was two worlds. Kirsten Dunst did one. Love story with two worlds.
I know what you're talking about.
Can't remember the name of it. And then this one, Elysium. So I have a theory that a lot of these movie makers get together and conspire. Hey, let's all make a movie about the same topic, and hopefully somebody will come see one of our movies. I don't know what their thought is, but I don't think it's accidental that a lot of those movies came out at the same time.
Upside down.
That's what it was.
All these world ending movies, world inverting, two worlds.
And I think they're trying to get into the popular psyche somehow and tell a story that lots of people will come see by tapping into the mood of the times. And interestingly, they usually get it wrong because
Sometimes it's studios trying to one up each other on an idea.
Yeah, it can be that too. So getting to Elysium, I'll say one general thing I liked about it, overall thing I liked about it, and then an overall thing I didn't like about it. I'll start with the bad news. I pretty much agree with Mark on this. That
it is bad news anytime anyone agrees with Mark.
Okay. So here's how I would put it. Anytime that your character development is 2 minutes of fast forward flashbacks, you're in trouble. So the movie starts out with about 2 minutes of let me develop this kid's character in flashback, in fast forward. So it's snippet, 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 snippet. All right, he was in an orphanage. Now he's grown up. Now he's stealing cars. That's all the character development you're going to get in this movie.
Extremely heavy.
Oh, my goodness. Is that all you're going to give me? And now you expect me to be all in this story. I saw it twice. I saw it for the second time yesterday. And that was the most ridiculous thing about the movie was just the opening. Fast forward flashbacks. That's what you're going to do for character development. Yeah. Come on. We'll get into this later, but contrast that to District 9. Good story, family dynamics, District 9. Yeah. And it's like he forgot half his brain in this movie. But I'll end on a positive note in terms of the overall picture of the movie or my overall view of the movie. I did like the movie as a think piece. I thought it was very, and one reviewer even said this, the intent of this movie was to provoke thought. And I do think it accomplished that probably better than any other movie that's come out this summer. I think it's provoked thought.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it definitely sparked a lot of controversy, which
usually is what it takes.
I mean, we talked about that with Man of Steel. I mean, they were obviously going for the blatant metaphor instead of being like, hey, did you notice it? It was like, we're going to point it out. So if you don't see it, you're kind of an idiot. And because they did that, it created the controversy that made people be like, what? Yeah. Why would they do this? I got to go see it now.
Right.
And at least they got people talking.
Which, interestingly, this movie, several of the reviewers paralleled this movie to Superman in terms of the Christ figure and the kind of self-sacrifice, the stabbing in the side and the blood dripping from the hands. Yeah. It wasn't as clear to me, but I guess some reviewers saw it.
I think I'd agree with that.
I think when we get a little more towards the end of the movie, we'll probably have to address that. But we have to talk about a lot of Max before we get to Max as that.
Yeah.
Before we actually get to the movie, I guess, itself, I want to kind of talk about this idea of political polarity and the war outside the movie between what would seem to be conservative America and liberal America, liberal Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because this basically kicked up all that dust. We have socialized medicine and the haves versus the have-nots, the 99%, the 1%. Is this movie, just as some conservative critics have claimed, an apologetic for Obamacare? We get that a lot. What was it? In one of the articles that we read, Dan Gaynor of the Conservative Media Research Center told Fox News, just keep going down the rabbit hole, this is just the latest of several Hollywood movies this year to try and co-opt Occupy Wall Street plot lines in their films. I mean, like, like, how far can we go? I mean, because it would do a disservice to say that this movie did not have social underpinnings.
Sure.
But, like, how far do you really take this? I mean, obviously, we believe that there are some narratives here that are worth talking about. Elijah's already pointed out
that
there's something worth talking about. It's a good conversation piece, but is this really trying to, like, trick people into believing, like, socialized medicine's okay?
See, to say that this is an American liberal agenda movie, like something for Obamacare or just a leftist, you know, propaganda type thing, I mean, it's just an uneducated statement because it completely ignores the fact that the writer-director is from South Africa. I mean, he's South African. So it's clearly not. I mean, it's from his brain. It's an original movie. And, you know, even if you want to go into conspiracy theory, even if, you know, Hollywood producers and even Matt Damon, because everybody's pointing out how Matt Damon is, you know, a socially charged actor, even if they had some kind of say in it, the whole idea is based in the mind of a South African person. So, you know, I don't understand the whole. I mean, it's just people trying to prove their own point out of something that's popular, and I think that's just it's ridiculous. But I liked that, you know, and I'll go into this a little bit more. But you know, I liked that. I like any sci-fi film that wants to use sci-fi to try to say something, and a lot of people were saying this was very preachy. I did not feel that this was preachy at all, and maybe I don't normally see preachiness. I just see a message, or I see a point or a theme. Did you guys think this was preachy at all? I mean, like, I didn't feel like I was being preached at.
I did.
Really?
Yeah. And I would actually disagree with your statement about the intent of the movie. So I would agree that Neil, is it Blomkamp or Blomkamp?
Blomkamp, I think it is.
However you say it.
Okay, yeah, I call him Blomkamp.
Just don't call him like Mind Comp or something, because then, you know, you start thinking you're like a conservative spy.
Really getting deep now.
Yeah. So, granted, he's from South Africa, so I would make two points on the political front. So his first movie was unabashedly political, but dealing with the politics of racism.
Yeah, it was about apartheid.
Apartheid, yeah. So it was based out of that. So I think he's already established a reputation for dealing with kind of hot-button topics from his previous movie. So the New York Times write-up of this interviews the guy that plays Kruger, who was the main lead character in District 9. Yeah,
Charlton Copley.
Yeah, he was lead in District 9.
So here's some quotes from him. "Our movie is a political statement. going down the middle weakens everything." And then here's the MRC co-chairman. "The only way to be successful is to be original."
Yeah.
Quotes, "Healthcare, immigration, working conditions, these are all part of our movie."
Yeah, he goes on to say playing it safe is the fastest way to ruin it.
Exactly.
Right. But so, to me, that doesn't mean that there, because Neil Blomkamp himself said in an interview, there's no message to this film.
Exactly. So they have
you got an actor saying there is, right, and a director and writer that's saying there's not.
So here's my theory on that. Number one, they have a massive messaging problem. Number two, I think it started off being very political, and I think the director and the one producer realized pretty quickly, if this movie gets branded before it's even hit the theaters as a liberal kind of case for whatever, universal health care, then it's going to hurt our bottom line pretty significantly. So I think Neil Blomkamp was doing damage control is what he was doing, and because he could tell that this was going to hurt the bottom line of the movie. So I think he was disingenuous. And even one of the reviewers said, it's ridiculous to say this movie has no message. Yeah. Like, what kind of dunces do you think we are?
But the idea of a message in a film, I mean, all the whole point of this whole podcast, blog, everything is movies have messages.
Right.
So what's the rub?
Well, I think the rub is when the message becomes more important than the story. So the poor character development was sacrificed because, from my perspective, the message and the creation of the worlds that communicated that message became more important than the story itself. And so they actually made a bad movie because they allowed the message that they wanted to get across to become more important than the story that they were telling.
I mean, I see it a little bit differently because I see it as He is a director and a writer, you know, as you know, he's got a very small track record, but he's a director and a writer that likes to put his, I think his background and his country's struggles and the struggles that he has seen all over the world. He likes to put that into his films, mm-hmm. which is pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he does a really good job of creating a world in sci-fi, like he did with District 9, yeah. like he did with this movie. And I think that just kind of comes out of him as a part of the world. The way he sees a futuristic sci-fi world, he doesn't see the glitzy and the glam of, like, technology just being this fantastic thing that makes our world just run, you know, very smoothly. He sees it as, like, if unemployment just continues to skyrocket and all these things, he sees a kind of a grim future. Mm-hmm. And so I think he puts that into his films and then focuses so much on creating the world, creating, because he said, I don't, what was one of the things he said was, I don't even know that I'm necessarily a director. I'm a visual storyteller. I'm a visual effects person kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He was very, very much focused on creating the visuals of this movie and the world of this movie, which is just naturally for him going to be a politically charged world. His story is so basic because I think he is not a good screenwriter. Like, I mean, really, because he even said, I hate screenwriting. Screenwriting is the worst possible part for me of creating a film. So I think the reason why it seems so preachy and seems so like there's so much message, it's so political, is because he's naturally political, but he doesn't know how to nuance a story like that. So because it's so heavy handed and because it's so beating you over the head with everybody, even the poor should get socialized medicine, you know, whether you agree with that or not, whatever, but that's what their message of the film was going for. I think that's just naturally kind of his thing. It's kind of like, to me, when you have a band, a music band, who's a bunch of Christians. Well, when do you draw the line of calling them a Christian band? When they say they're a Christian band, or like all of their songs are only about Jesus? You know, it's like, or you just have a band who all the guys are in it are Christians, but they write songs about life and girls and, you know, other things. I mean, so to me, it's like he's just this kind of a filmmaker and he just made a really bad script. So that's why I felt like I was preached at, because I just saw all the holes and all the problems in the script much more than like we completely ignored everything so that we could tell a social justice story.
Well, I feel like you have to write what you know.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think he did. And I think the thing that really stuck out to me wasn't that there was political charged conversation about it, because I think there wasn't a lot of that with District 9 until after the film had come out. I think he may have done himself a disservice by putting Matt Damon in this film. Matt Damon had just come out with like The Promised Land, and The Promised Land was obviously, you know, like an anti-fracking film, and it kind of bombed a little bit because people kind of knew what they were going to get. So in this case, he still just is writing what he knows.
However, that's a good movie that is very nuanced and not just a anti-fracking movie.
Which is what Elijah was saying earlier. You know, that he was doing some damage control. He didn't want this to get out, being like, "Oh, this is just another Matt Damon pushing his personal political views through his Hollywood vehicle." Mm-hmm. You know, so they're trying to say, "Oh no, there's other things going on. It's it's whatnot." And when you ask, "Do I feel preached at?" I didn't really feel preached at necessarily, because I felt like, I mean, was this ultimately really any different than watching an episode of Star Trek?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if like you didn't have certain people attached to this film, like in Star Trek, you had your crew going to worlds that were much different than the pseudo idealized world that we had all come to agree was great because we were all behind the Federation.
Yeah,
you know, and when they go to when they go to a planet that doesn't allow gender, when they go to a planet that's like killing people once they get, you know, 50 years of age, you know, we are like against all this stuff. But we, you know, there's not like conservative blogs or, you know, things like that being like, if you're a real Christian, you're going to be against this. Why aren't they against Star Trek? There's obviously something else here that's kind of triggering that.
Well, I think this is another good comparison to District 9, and I can't remember if a reviewer said this or if I just thought about it based on something parallel that a reviewer said, but the gist of it was the special effects, the sci-fi special effects, are more exciting and have more of a wow factor to them, the more I feel connected to the characters. So when you do poor character development, the sci-fi has less... the sci-fi and the special effects have less impact.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't care if the robot just got blown up if I don't really feel connected to the guy that just blew the robot up and was life was threatened by the robot. So I do think there's a connection between the way your heart is pulled into the character of District 9 and then all the special effects that happen there
mm-hmm.
versus the way your heart is not pulled in to a lot of the characters of Elysium and the special effects just have. So I think it goes to show that the cliche relationship trumps everything. So if you don't mm-hmm. have a relationship with the character, then any amount of special effects can't overcome
that deficiency. That's the balance of filmmaking for sure. I mean, you know, that's why I think that this film is less like just trying to be overtly preachy and ignoring everything else. And it's more just a failure of the filmmaking because I feel like if this story were as nuanced and as, paced as well as District 9 was and focused more on the character of Max and, you know, any kind of other thing other than, like, I got to go get this thing so that I can get on a ship to go get healed. And then the daughter comes in. I mean, it's just all just very cliche, heavy-handed, blatant storytelling. I felt like if it were more like District 9 with Pacer, people wouldn't be as upset as they were. I mean, they obviously would be making a big deal out of it because it's a popular movie and people like to take popular movies and say, it says something I disagree with. Hello, does anybody see this? And everybody, do you agree with me or disagree with me? And come read my blog. You know, like, I feel like this is more of a failure of just storytelling than anything.
So I would agree with that, but I want to lay out the case for the preachiness, like with specific examples.
Yeah, I'm actually really interested.
Okay, so Los Angeles in 2154 is mm-hmm. almost exclusively overrun by a Hispanic population. No parallel to the modern immigration debate there or anything like that. Elysium is almost exclusively white. And there's
mm-hmm. except for the president.
Except for the president, right? Which we got to have that to keep our multicultural ideals in place. and has almost zero character development, and any character development that does happen there is bad. So it's a power-hungry defense secretary. So mm-hmm. it's very, very simplistic, and when it ever happens, negative character development of Elysium. Workplace environment is total heavy-handed. Don't replace the bed sheets. I don't want to lose $2 on replacing bed sheets. Like,
yeah,
come on. I mean, is that the best you can do to describe a nuanced workplace environment? So his death and everything that happens there is pretty his workplace injury, everything that happens there is pretty over the top, preachy, I think. So usually the preachiness comes in the depiction of bad guys. So anytime a bad guy is depicted as exclusively bad, like at least what Superman did with General Zod, at least it showed him having some somewhat noble motives. I want to preserve the race.
But when you
here, there was no noble motives whatsoever to the bad guys. So that's when it starts to get preachy.
She wanted to protect her children. Like, well, would you not do anything for your children? So we have up until the very end of the movie, Max, who's very self-centered, he's only concerned about himself, or to some degree, possibly the girl that he liked when he was younger.
Right.
And so he's just doing whatever is best for him. So we have the people on the ground just as selfish as the people up top, but they're all doing it for, I think a very similar reason. I don't think it was well done, mm-hmm. because Jodie Foster got like one line, you know, like, we would do everything for our children.
Now let me go blow up a couple spaceships. Yeah. Like, come on, I'm not very sympathetic to you.
She was
miscast,
horribly miscast, but horribly written. Terribly written.
Yeah. Awful. Which affects the character
development. It does,
But this makes me, that very thing, like, I noticed that, and I talked to some other people about the movie who kind of come from a different kind of political leaning than I do. I mm-hmm. say political, but like just worldview mm-hmm. leaning than I do. And they kind of picked up on some, what you just said, you know, people up there were, rich people were evil.
Right.
Poor people were good.
Yeah.
And I was like, were they really? I mean, the poor people here were doing very bad things to each other. And the rich people, I mean, they were just trying to preserve their way of life, you know, and make sure they maintained a high lifestyle for their offspring protecting their family. What's more noble than protecting your family? Mm-hmm. Unless you have a weird sort of French, not really accent, and you're trying to overthrow the government. But, you know, what did they do that was so noble down on, you know, on Earth? And so I'm wondering if this is kind of like when I read the one review who said, like, in America, it's really easy for us to see this movie and socially say Elysium's the 1%. And, mm-hmm. you know, Los Angeles apparently is the 99%. But if you take this movie to the rest of the world, if you take it to, like, a South Africa or a third world country, this doesn't become the 1% versus the 99% anymore. This becomes, like, the rest of the world almost versus America. Mm-hmm. America is the place that everyone's trying to get.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean...
So, I mean, I'm thinking worldview here. I think it's really easy for us to argue from a very American perspective.
No, that's...
But I think it does a disservice to the movie.
I would agree with that. So, I can't remember, again, if it's one of the reviewers or was a side thought on a reviewer's comment, but is Elysium America, essentially?
Right.
Are we... I think it was a reviewer that was talking about this. Like, everybody wants to come to our shores the same way that everybody wanted to get to mm-hmm. the Elysium Med Lab or whatever it's called. Here's another heavy-handed contrast, I think. So anytime you go to Elysium, you cut to the Vivaldi violin music. Anytime you go back to Los Angeles, it's like kind of heavy hip-hop, urban beat music.
Industrial sounds. Industrial, you know,
yeah.
Like,
so it's like...
machines churning and stuff like that.
Very loud, yeah. Confusing.
Noisy.
Yeah. And so it's like... I mean, the way one reviewer, this was an NPR, said, I hope you... are picking up what Blomkamp is laying down here because he's laying it down with a trowel. Yeah. Translate the word trowel for preaching. Yeah, I think they're kind of synonyms in some ways.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't want to say that this doesn't have a very heavy message because it has a heavy message because it's just so clunky.
Yeah,
you know, everything's so clunky and everything. Mm-hmm. So this is what I believe.
Right. Lack of nuance is another way.
Yeah.
I think you could say clunky. Exactly. Lack of nuance.
So, I mean, that really is the issue versus, like, I mean, here's a question that I kind of have about all this. You know, when somebody says a movie is too preachy, mm-hmm. it's like, I mean, do we, you know, if Blomkamp, if all of his movies want to be sci-fi movies that deal with some kind of social justice, okay, whether they're good or whether they're bad, you know, District 9 was good. It dealt with apartheid in a very, you know, just this is the setting type of way mm-hmm. versus this one is like, this is the message. This is what's bad. Right, this is right. what's good. It right. just they didn't take the time. So if he makes 3, 4, 5 more movies that are just like this, have the same kind of setting, et cetera, you know, we can say that's his kind of a filmmaker. Well, what if we have a filmmaker who's makes dramas, he's a Buddhist, and he puts very Buddhist ideals into his movie. Are we going to say that that's very preachy because all of the character decisions and motivations and lifestyle choices and, you know, themes and everything deal with this very kind of Buddhist idea of life? I mean, is that what's, you know...
Yeah, I don't think that's what makes it preachy. I think it goes back to what I said about this, the story versus the message. So...
But how does an unnuanced workplace where they don't want to pay $2 for sheets make it preachy? You know what I'm saying? Because like, you used some examples there that I thought, I'm going with you on your point. I totally see where you're coming from. But I know that this movie has a very heavy message. But
right.
I guess in terms of films and how we see films, where's the line that we step over to say, this is preachy and this is not?
Yeah.
Because all films have messages.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. So I think... It's how the message is conveyed and how you communicate the message to me. So take Les Mis, for example. Les Mis has a very mm-hmm. similar workplace scene where the girl's name, I can't remember.
Yeah.
Who she is.
Yeah.
Am I making that up?
Fontaine.
Yeah.
Fontaine. She like has a note delivered to her. She's begging the other coworkers not to let the boss know because she's going to get kicked out and then she won't be able to take care of her daughter. And you've gotten to know her up to that point, and so you find your heart being much more sympathetic to, oh, I hope the note doesn't get out, or whatever it was she was trying to hide. I hope the boss doesn't find out about it. And then the worst happens, and your heart kind of breaks for her. So I think it's kind of an intangible, how is the message communicated? Like, does the director see me as so simple that he has to have this, kind of cheesy line, don't replace the sheets, they cost too much, versus, oh, the director's really helped me to get to know Fontaine, and now I know that she has a daughter and that she's the sole provider and she's having to sleep with her boss or whatever to keep her job. And so all this stuff, I'm probably getting a few of those details wrong, but there's a lot more. The director's been much more respectful of my intelligence.
I agree.
To communicate his message.
Yeah,
to
absolutely
me.
Agree there. He was not so much in this film at all. So
so here's the beauty of why I bring this up, because we're dancing all around it.
You've had this wicked smile.
I have. I mean, the whole time. See, but this is what I love about it. The entire reason we have this podcast is because we believe that there are themes, narratives, like ideas in every single story. And it just makes me laugh because in this story, it doesn't deal with any themes that we haven't dealt with before in movies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's saying, you know, nothing new under the sun. But because it's obvious, suddenly people are like, watch out, this movie has a message.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, every movie has a message.
Yeah, sure.
And I think it's just, it's preachy because people can figure it out. So, you know, like we talked about Pacific Rim. Pacific Rim last week, you know, one of its criticisms was that it was a turn your brain off, no substance, monsters versus, you know,
machine robot
things, you know, which once we started breaking it down on the podcast, you're like, wait, there's other things going here. They're subtle. There's not a ton of it. You know, it's maybe one or two overarching themes, but it's still telling us something about how we see, how we view, how we interpret humanity, how we see the afterlife, how we see our place in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And this right here just kind of says, this is how I see the universe. You know, this is how I see the world. I'm from South Africa and it stinks when people aren't treated equal, you know?
Yeah.
And someone's like, God, we see your hand, put it down.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so this is why everyone out there should be telling their friends to listen to this podcast.
Yeah, right.
So let me give some background on why I think this movie was so much not as good as District 9. And I think the key was in the one producer, I didn't write his name down, but he was interviewed in the New York Times article. And the article contrasted Elysium to White House Down. So White House Down had six producers, and Elysium had one producer. And this one producer, this is what he said. He said, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said, Blomkamp basically earned the right to do whatever he wanted in this movie. And his point was that District 9 played a huge role in the freedom that Blomkamp had here, which, reading between the lines, I think there was probably a lot of hands-on management of Blomkamp and critique and pushback and let's change this. So I think there was much more of a process in how District 9 was made. I think that process was largely done away with. I think he had much more free rein and free hand. And I think that actually hurt this movie.
Sure.
And I would actually make a theological point here that whenever we're given the freedom to do whatever we want, and we are, in some sense, we have the permission or the freedom to take ourselves out of community and out of accountability, it results in a poor end result. And just to make that practical, I would parallel that to what's happening with marriage today. So marriage is kind of on the downward spiral, the downward track. It's too constraining or whatever. But I think a lot of people who are married and have put some thought into that process would say and have said that it actually refines them as a person more, being married. It makes them a better person because they're now accountable to somebody else. So when you have a nation full of Neil Blomkamps who have free reign to do whatever they want with their life and no accountability to anybody, I think societally you end up with a poorer end result. Same way that he ended up with a poorer second movie than he did a first movie, where he probably had more accountability and community.
So he was more married to District 9, where it seemed like he was maybe like kind of dating Elysium or kind of taking Elysium on a one-night stand.
It was a one-night stand, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I wonder about, you know, because I'm not familiar with all the different, you know, processes of every film, you know, because like which producers have a hand on which things. And you know, and that's why I kind of wonder about the preachiness and the overall heavy-handedness of, like, you know, did he get a system of checks and balances or did he not? You know, did he get it on District 9, or was District 9 just a stroke of genius? You know?
Or luck.
Or luck. You know, Because the story of District 9 was, it was a short film that he had done.
Yeah.
And then from that, Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings fame, you know, got him to be the director on a gigantic, big budget movie version of the video game Halo.
Right.
And so when Halo fell through, Peter Jackson got a budget for him to still do a movie, and it became District 9. Mm-hmm. So it was, a lot of it was already created from his brain. So I wonder about that checks and balances. But this movie also kind of, I think a good parallel for me was a movie that I vehemently hated called Children of Men. Uh-huh. That came out in 2006. Brazil. Did you ever see it? No, it was Alfonso Cuarón, who is a fantastic filmmaker, but I just hated that movie because it had very similar heavy-handed, waving the hand, this is what's wrong and what's right, guys, type of movie. And
Clive Owen.
It's a,
Clive Owen. I didn't like it. Oh,
I did see that. Yeah, Clive Owen.
I mean, just to read the synopsis, in 2027, so we're a little bit closer to 2154, but it's a chaotic world in which women have somehow all become infertile, and a former activist agrees to help transport a miraculously pregnant woman to a sanctuary at sea. Right. So it's got this, like, you know, very heavy-handed, purposeful message to say. It says a lot of stuff. There's a whole thing about where it's kind of in the background, but it's really, really obvious, and it almost identically parallels the images from Guantanamo Bay. And there's just all this stuff that's very, very heavy-handed, and I kind of felt preached at. So, you know, looking at this movie and saying, I don't know if I felt preached at versus I just saw a clunky movie with a very blatant message, versus that one was there to sit, because Children of Men was very well done. I just didn't like it because it was so bleak and its message was just so, you know, negative. I thought about the world and stuff like that. So
here's an interesting thought about that. Can you think of one movie that paints a future world that's good? Like, don't all future world type movies?
Star Trek.
Star Trek. I mean, Star Trek is it's the entire universe of the Federation. The Federation has, we've solved all our problems.
We've eliminated
money.
Poverty.
Yeah, we don't have money. We don't have poverty. We don't have a system. So, yeah, I mean, that was Gene Roddenberry's, like, very utopian vision of the future.
Yeah.
So there are some movies that do, but a lot of it, you're right. I mean, a lot of it, sci-fi is like,
this is how bad it's going to be in the future if you don't deal with such and such problem now, kind of thing. Where a lot of it goes.
Yeah, well, here's a great question. Yeah. I mean, based on our current worldviews,
right?
What's more likely to happen is, in you guys' opinion, is it more likely that we're gonna cure poverty and, you know, cure starvation? We're gonna find that we don't need money anymore. Everyone just does whatever, and it's cool. Or we're gonna be like driving around in leather chaps trying to get gas from somewhere in Australia.
Book of Eli.
Mad Max.
Memorizing thing, you know, walking around fighting cannibals.
Post-apocalyptic is what people like to call
it. Yeah, I mean, like, so,
what is the apocalypse going to be consistent
I think one of the things, what's more likely?
Well, what I think about when I think about, like, you know, when people say, because I'm a huge sci-fi fan, obviously, and I love sci-fi and fantasy, and so I've always thought about, you know, that you know, there's not a whole lot of movies, like you say, that create a positive outlook on life. Well, what if, you know, we were able to create a movie that was almost identical, or a story that was almost identical to the way our world is right now, and showed it to somebody back in the 20s or 30s? Would they think that this is an ideal world, or would they think it's really messed up? Yeah, so, I mean it is kind of like,
this isn't my fault for WW2.
But I mean, like,
that's a good point.
That can get into, like, really corny, clunky, offensive territory. I think if you go too far with that, you know, so I don't mean it in that regard. I just mean it in terms of, like, you know, I think sci-fi has a chance to explore the future, and it has to very, when you create a sci-fi world, you have to be very purposeful with the visuals that you show to kind of, not only does, you know, establish the technology and the way that the world works, but you also have to be very blatant about the right and the wrong and the stuff that's going on in that world. And so it gives it that opportunity to show right and wrong on a very different level. But
I think that's the whole point behind creating an alternate world, is it gives you a parallel way to talk about your world.
Yeah.
So basically, if you look at Tolkien was a master of this. So Tolkien created incredibly nuanced, incredibly detailed story world of Middle Earth, or whatever his I can't remember if there was another name for his whole world. C.S. Lewis, interestingly, did the same thing with Narnia and other mm-hmm. worlds that he created, Polyandra. And so I think it becomes a question of how good are you at creating that world, and how nuanced are you at bringing your readers or your viewers
sure.
into that sure, world. Absolutely. And I think so there's a lot of opportunity in creating another world, because it's a non-threatening way to speak to your audience about current realities.
Right.
But I think your audience picks up pretty quickly whether or not you're a good storyteller or not, and whether or not they trust you to speak to them through that world.
I think good storytelling, are you a good filmmaker? And since we're talking about films in particular, are you bad at being a filmmaker because you're trying to be too preachy and you completely ignore all the things just to get your message out? Or are you just, you have a message that you kind of hoped you could make a nuanced film with, and you wanted to set a story in, and you're just really bad at the storytelling part of it. You know, the actual filmmaking part of it versus like, I don't care about the filmmaking side. Cause I felt like Alfonso Cuarón with Children of Men, he's a very, very good filmmaker. So his film was fantastic and it was well paced and well written and all that stuff. But he was caring a whole lot about the message, and I thought that overwhelmed the film. So that, to me, that was kind of the difference between the two. And I mean, I think when you're talking about other worlds, you just have an opportunity to really kind of point out sometimes very obvious and very blatant things, but you get to do it a fresh way.
Right. Yeah.
And so that, I mean, that's why we're all drawn to sci-fi. I mean, I think is because sci-fi is so unique and fun and different and fresh. And, you know, I think about, when I think about, like, you know, looking at the future and looking at it in an incorrect way, I think about Back to the Future, because back, you know, we're not going to have flying cars and 80s memorabilia everywhere in 2015.
Well, the cool thing, I know this is getting off track a little bit, but the cool thing about Back to the Future is that it's not an oppressively bad world, and it's not an over-impressively idealistic world. It's kind of like our world, but kind of, and so there's, I think it's more, in some senses, besides the flying cars, I think Back to the Future has a truer feel to it.
Absolutely. I don't think
the future is going to be as bad as Elysium says it is.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's going to be as good as Star Trek says it is. So exactly. That's a little bit of what's kind of feels over the top about futuristic movies, is when they make the future look terrible, or when they make the future look overly idealistic.
Well, so we still have time to actually talk about specifics of the movie itself.
Okay. Yeah.
I want to ask one last question to corral this general subject.
Mm-hmm.
The movie got a lot of backlash, especially a lot of, like I said, conservative, specifically Christian backlash, because of the themes that portended. So do you feel that was deserved?
I guess that's the argument that we're having right now. Deserved in the sense of... well, I think I could say it, answer it two ways. Do I think that any time that an opinion like that is thrown out there about a film that has a politically charged message is deserved? No, I don't think it's needed. I mean, I don't think it should get trashed just because one person has a different belief system than the person who made the film. However, it is a film with a politically charged message, and it's putting it out there to a mass audience, so fair and square. Anybody can talk about it. Anybody can say anything.
And maybe should be talked about.
Yeah, and maybe should be talked about. So, I mean, it, in that sense, it is fair, I mean, to answer your question. But, I mean, you can take any movie, because that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You can take any movie and disagree with it or agree with it and use it to prove your point or disprove your point. You know, whatever. And I just think, you know, the... so-and-so did this because they believe this, and that's why this movie is... You shouldn't see this movie. I mean, it's just... You can get pretty loony with it. So I disagree with a lot of what was said, but, you know, it nevertheless, it's there to be said.
So I would criticize this movie. I would criticize the message of this movie, but for different reasons. First, let me say one of my favorite quotes is, "Politics is theology diluted." And so I think this movie is theology diluted in a lot of ways, because it's getting very much into politics, I think. So my critique of this movie, is that it tried to present a very clear portrayal of the good life and the bad life.
Mm-hmm.
So the good life is very much Elysium, classical music, perfectly manicured lawns, perfect body healing machines, robots serving you champagne, airspace that's protected. I mean, so Elysium was, in essence, I think what Blomkamp was presenting as the good life.
Right.
That was the ideal. And then Los Angeles 2154 was his attempt to kind of present the opposite of that. So the starting line on the screen is, in the year 2154, the earth is diseased, polluted, and overpopulated. So what is the bad life? The bad life is disease, pollution, and overpopulation.
And more so than the bad life, he's kind of saying the unfair life a little bit, I think.
Okay,
he's saying that this is not right. This is
right.
This is unfair to do this to people.
Yeah, I could agree with
you.
So it's bad and it's unfair.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's people are they're fighting to get to Elysium. They're trying to take spaceships there. They're having workplace injuries. They are treated callously by their robotic probation officer.
Mm-hmm.
They're given, interestingly, this theme of pills comes up. Your heart rate appears overrated. Would you like a pill?
Yeah.
I mean, and then he gets pills when he's about to die. And so here's my critique of that. So Blomkamp is presenting the good life and the bad life in exclusively materialistic terms. And I think that is from a Christian perspective, I think that's a misdefinition of the good life and the bad life. I think it's an incredibly oversimplistic definition of the good life and the bad life.
I agree.
And so if I have a criticism, I would actually make a lot of parallels between this movie and the book of Exodus. So in the book of Exodus, Moses is delivering, God is sending Moses to deliver Israel from the bad life. And he is bringing both a political deliverance and spiritual deliverance. And so by defining the bad life and the good life in strictly materialistic terms, Blomkamp does a tremendous disservice to what I think a healthy definition of the good life and the bad life are.
And I think that's his... I sound like I keep defending the movie, and I'm not. But I think that's his failure as a filmmaker, because I don't necessarily think he defines, you know, what would be the ultimate life for everyone would be to be on Elysium. Because I don't think he paints Elysium in a light that is completely positive. I mean, it's all negative about Elysium.
Right.
But what you're saying is right. Like, I'm agreeing. I'm just kind of taking it to that. What does he maybe actually believe? But,
right.
You know, you're right. In simplifying it and dumbing it down in those terms, it almost completely takes apart his own message of social justice, because it's not the true sides of things.
Yeah, and you even have internal things to the movie that kind of hint at this a little bit. So when the defense minister, what's her name?
Jodie Foster.
Miss Bad Actor.
Yeah. Jodie Foster. So when Jodie Foster is dying, she's been stabbed in the neck by Kruger with a piece of glass, and Frey is applying pressure to the bleeding wound.
Yeah.
She says, no more. Like, let me die. I've had enough. So this person who had power and who had the perceived good life doesn't want to live the good life anymore. So kind of interesting thing there. And then on the other side, what was the other? Here's an interesting thing, and this is where he brings in a little bit of spirituality, potentially. I think the movie is framed in the beginning and the ending by the words of the nuns.
Yeah.
So the nuns,
The
nuns say, you have purpose, you have meaning, you have a destiny. Remember where you came from, I think is one of the last lines of the movie. It was one of his flashbacks. And so in that sense... In that sense, I think you could say there's a little bit of a spiritual undertone. But here's how I think this affects us as Americans. I think we perceive ourselves as having the good life because we're in the wealthiest country in the world. And I think we perceive people in like sub-Saharan Africa as having the bad life.
Mm-hmm.
But having friends that have been there, one of the things that shocks them about sub-Saharan Africa is how can the people have so little and be so joyful? Mm-hmm. Like they don't understand how they can be happy.
Yeah.
And then they would probably come over here And the question about us would be, how can y'all have so much and be so depressed?
Yeah.
And so, and so we, I think we live out this false definition of the good life and the bad life. And anytime you have closer than a skin depth encounter with what you perceive to be the bad life, you actually see that it's much more nuanced than three cars or two cars or whatever in a house and plenty of food on your table. Doesn't necessarily, or not having those things doesn't necessarily make it miserable, and having those things doesn't necessarily make it great. So that's where I think that his theology is being, and I guess I'm reading between the lines a little bit here, but if politics is theology diluted, I think his theology is overly materialistic.
Yeah, well, completely watered down to the bare essentials, and it just, that's when the message starts to get lost.
Well, I feel like that's why I don't really pull for anybody like in the, on the poor team. And I don't really pull for anybody on the rich team. I actually pull for the nuns because the nuns are the one being like, you know, like you think you're basically looking up at Elysium. He's telling you, little Matt Damon, like, look, that's where you want to go. But think about, like, you know, you think it's going to be great, but what's really going to be great about it? And I wish I had the exact quote.
Right.
But apparently people hated the movie so much they didn't put a lot of quotes online. But you know, that's her whole spiel, you know. Like, remember where you came from. And I feel like that's the root of it, because I don't think we're supposed to root for the poor people necessarily or the rich people, because I think it, like you said, it is all materialistic. And that, this was the thing that I picked up on the most. I read the articles before I went in, and I'm just supposed to look and see, like, rich people are evil, poor people are, you know, great and oppressed, and they need to rise up. And I was looking for that. But the only thing that hit me was that how sad it was that Matt Damon didn't listen to the people that brought him up. So he grew up, and he worked a crappy job that he didn't like for the promise, and what would be a false promise, that one day he could, his life would be better way down the road. And all it struck me, and it was like the first thing that I really wanted to address, was almost like the myth of the happiness of retirement. You know, like, one day you're going to work so hard and you're going to save up enough money from going into the little radioactive place that you're going to get to a place where you don't have to work anymore. You just get robots that serve you champagne. And it's a lie. And I think that was, like I said, that was the thing that hit me more than almost anything in the movie, until right there at the end when he finally becomes a sympathetic character, which, and I want to talk about Max specifically later, but I kind of wanted, like, did anyone else pick up on this, like, non-idealized dream? Like, I felt like I was watching the American dream from a foreigner's perspective and looking at how silly it looked.
I think a lot of times a hero's journey starts off with a different intention that then they eventually go into trying to obtain. Like, little Max is looking up at this ideal world and looking at all the struggle around him and saying, wouldn't it be great if I had that, or I could be there? Life would be so much easier. And I really like what you're, you know, saying about the nuns, especially about destiny, because, you know, destiny is the reason I went to see this film. I wanted to see what Matt Damon's character's destiny was going to be, you know, because from the, well, seriously, because from the trailer, it is, he's going to be able to do something that no other person in this world has been able to do. He's going to get a really cool gun and a really cool exoskeleton to do it. There's going to be a lot of sci-fi action. He's going to be a hero. You know, the hero's journey is in basically every movie we've talked about this summer. I mean, it's in tons and tons and tons of movies. And this, you know, so I know what a hero's journey is going to be. And I was intrigued by the setup of this movie, and that there was injustice and there's some kind of bad guy that in Jodie Foster that needs to be defeated. And he was going to be able to go up there and fight the bad guys, and they were going to have something. That's the basic story that I was there going there to see. And I wanted to see it done in a really cool way. And, you know, so that's what I was drawn to. But it's the idea of destiny that is the reason that we kind of go see these films, is because the hero has a fulfillment to do. So, you know, I don't think Matt Damon's drive the entire film, even though it is part of it, it is just to live this retirement life, this cushy life. I think he, you know, he's kind of an anti-hero at first. He's a criminal. He's got a rough background. He hangs out with rough people. Even though some of his friends are really well-intentioned and stuff like that. I mean, they're struggling to survive. But he's a criminal, and I think, his whole purpose, once he, gets irradiated and has, is going to die in a few days, his whole purpose is just to save himself. I got to get up there, and I'm going to go kill a bunch of people is so that I can save myself. I'm going to blow down the doors with my gun, and I'm going to go.
When did that happen? I don't think he ever intended. This is a conversation I had with somebody else who was upset that what seemed like was the underprivileged had to fight his way, like, onto Elysium. He went and gave himself up. He assumed that he was going to be taken up there, and not really. He wasn't planning. I mean, he had to fight to kill the one guy, to get the information in the first place. But then he gave himself up. He didn't go to Elysium to start a fight. He found a fight when he went to Elysium.
Right. So, but the
I think that's a very important
distinction. Well, the whole motivation is I need to go to Elysium. Give me a ticket. You know, he goes to his buddy and says, "Look, I'll work for you." Mm-hmm. For however long to pay off my debts, just so I can get a ticket. I just want to get healed up there. So it's all based on his motivation. Well, then he has to go kill people or take by force something that this guy wants and do this dirty job for him so that then he can get his ticket to go to Elysium. So,
yeah, don't get me wrong. He's entirely self-motivated.
He's entirely self-motivated.
I think he's got, like, the most of intentions of almost any character, which is why I think we don't like him for most of the movie.
Well, and I think they linger too long on that part of the hero's journey. But I think a lot of heroes' journeys start off, their destiny is to be something greater than them, than they even themselves know that they're going to be. And so he starts off in the similar way of saying, I just need to get mine. I'm tired of waiting. Now I'm sick. I got to get up there. And he goes in very self-motivated and very clunkily, non-nuanced way they throw in there very heavy-handedly that there's something more to life and you should probably, go up there for that, with that. So, I mean, it was very clunky and everything, but it's the typical hero's journey to me is that you start off with one intention and you realize what sacrifice that's going to take and you choose ultimately to, am I going to put myself in harm's way to help somebody else besides myself? And that's what he chooses to do. So I don't know that necessarily his whole point throughout the movie is just to live this cushy lifestyle. He's at the very least, once he changes to help this girl out, he's going up there to heal her and himself, but to heal her as well, and at least to help them. And, spoiler alert, he eventually goes up there real and he realizes, which is just a completely contrived thing that the filmmakers obviously wanted to get to, but he realizes he can make everybody citizens of Elysium and they can all get healed and have this universal healthcare and that's that kind of thing. So that, I mean, it's all kind of, this movie doesn't work because it just tries to do like all of these very forced things, but nonetheless, to kind of like go on to respond to what you're saying, I don't think it's to get up there to Elysium because Elysium is the ultimate.
Well, I think it was at the beginning, but once he gets sick, it shows how silly his dream was because it shows how fragile life is and how quickly the best laid plans of him not stealing anymore will turn someone into the worst of characters.
And to respond a little bit to what you're saying, I think there is a very similar, because I mean, this guy's from South Africa. I think there is a very It's not explicitly said, it's just kind of there, but there's this feeling that, like the people who live in this futuristic Los Angeles that's very overrun and plagued don't necessarily want to, like the nun is saying, I think the nuns are the key here, they don't necessarily want exactly what they have up there, but they realize that they're being oppressed and that life where they are, they're fine, they have their friends, they have their family and their community, but they... they're sick, they need help. And so they're trying to do the only thing that they know. It's like with the people who go up on the ship, at the first ship that goes up and tries to make it to Elysium. They're just trying to get there so they can get their children healed. And, there's this plague stuff that's going on and all that stuff. So there's that part of it that I don't necessarily think that they're saying that Elysium is what everybody should long for. I think they're just saying that, there needs to be some kind of community, bridging of the gap. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Well, and even at the end of the movie, one of my problems was it didn't really answer any of the questions that it raised.
Exactly, yeah, and it didn't.
Because ultimately, everyone's a citizen of Elysium, but no one really goes to Elysium. Well, the ships come down to them, and they're all going to have to go live. And we're assuming warlords aren't going to come, and greed and power is going to shift hands again, and So,
I mean, one of the key themes of the movie, I think, was that Matt Damon was making the instruments of his oppression. So the same way the slaves in Egypt made bricks for to build the pyramids of the pharaohs that oppressed them, Matt Damon is making the robots that break his arm.
Yeah.
So that's part of the I guess injustice of the movie. You were talking about the hero's journey and all that, and it just hit me. I don't think there's really a sympathetic character in the movie until at least the last third.
Yeah, no,
so I wonder if that affects our attachment to the movie. Like, I think in our hearts we go to a movie wanting to get attached to a character and like wanting to live in his or her shoes and aspire to what they aspire to and root for them. But when a director keeps you from being attached to a character,
I was rooting for the nuns.
I mean, right? You root for somebody and then you don't hear about him until the end of the movie.
Yeah, they're wanting you to be attached to Matt Damon's character, but they don't do it well enough to where that you are.
Yeah,
they don't make you care about him.
Yeah, exactly. He goes and hears the meerkat story, and he walks out the door and says, "I don't want to be a hippo. I'll see you later." And so I was like, okay, well, I thought I liked him, but now I don't because he just.
Well, even the daughter. I mean, the daughter is an obvious, you know, ploy to the message, to the change in him and everything like that. I mean, she's very cliche, but they're trying to get you to kind of be on her side, but they don't give enough of her character, or her story.
Right.
To
same with Frey,
the girl.
Like, so, she sounds cool, but then you don't see her until she gets
not much of Little Matilda either.
They don't really, you know, explore in this movie how everything kind of came to be. They just said, so this is the future. Mm-hmm. And you're like, it probably is. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just supposed to believe it. They don't, you know, these little medical beds, they're like little tanning beds that cure absolutely every disease in your body by just the wave of a light over you. I mean, how did that not get, you know, how does somebody not know how to make that and distribute it to all people? I mean, like...
They can hack into the network, but they can't make a medical bed.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, I don't understand.
Well, I want to talk about Max as, like a totally deprived character, kind of. I think we've all agreed that we weren't with Max at all. Like, we didn't like Max. He had the worst of motivations. And we don't even really find him remotely sympathetic until the very end when he sacrifices himself. Like, why? I mean, I would say, if anything, we don't like him because he reminds us probably of ourselves most of the time. If we had a different worldview than everyone at this table specifically has, if I believed in, like, survival of the fittest, you know, or if I believed that...
You were Ayn Rand.
Yeah, if I was Ayn Rand. Yeah. Like, why am I not rooting him on, being like, that's a man who is getting the best for himself? You know, why... If most people probably seeing this movie don't believe in the same worldview, why are they so inclined to root for somebody? You know, I mean, Philippians says, let each of you look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others. And I think that's something that almost everyone gets behind, you know, even non-Christians. So I think that says a lot about, like, what culture doesn't realize they already believe, like things that are already kind of written on them. But that's just what I think. I mean, like, the beauty of Max to me is I feel like I identified most with Max when he was being a selfish jerk. Because I feel like that's how I make most of my decisions. Now, I justify them. He justified his. I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't help you. The best thing I can do would be to run away from you instead of actually engaging the problem, instead of sacrificing something for himself. You know, he's basically just thinking about himself all the time. I mean, can you see Max as like... the everyman?
I think the time that I was most sympathetic to Max was when he got gassed in the in the robot chamber.
Yeah.
And then he's on his deathbed and he gets the pills and he's kind of given the pink slip and sent home to die. So I think there is a moment where we're sympathetic to him, and then he gets bone sawed, and that's like kind of weird but cool at the same time. Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is that they turn the sympathetic thing off and on, and they do it in such a way that you're never attached enough to Mac for the attachment to last through the moments that they turn the sympathy off. So when he rejects the little girl or runs out of the house and says, the best thing I can do is leave you behind, it's like, okay, I mean, that was selfish and I don't care for you enough to actually hope that you'll go back to the house and undo mm-hmm. what you just did. So yeah, I mean, it's just a general shallow attachment that I think is the problem.
Well, I mean, there is a, it's kind of strange to say, but this is the way I know how to say it. There, when we see when we have an everyman character in a film like this, when you're on the hero's journey kind of thing, you want kind of a selfless selfishness. And I think that is like, you know, I kind of think of it as like, you know, like in Batman Begins, like Batman is like the reason why he wants to learn all these things. And at first he's very like, I want justice. So I want to just go live in the prison and beat the crap out of all of these murderers and
justifying people
and prisoners. And then he, you know, somebody gives him a chance to be something bigger.
That's a good example.
And, you know, he wants to save an entire city and protect an entire city.
Right.
So he's very kind of selfish in his, I want to be the one who brings justice, but I want to bring justice for a bunch of people.
Right.
And I think that's what was missing for Max.
Right. A clear understanding of his motivation. So he's not stealing cars anymore and he's working steady, but why?
That was one thing I was really disappointed about.
Why is he
about.
Not stealing cars anymore?
Kind of going back to what you're saying about, you know, going over to a country that is impoverished, but they have so much joy and they have so much life. I was missing that from Max and just him kind of like learning from his mistakes and being okay with where he is, but realizing that something could be done and there's something greater to him and that kind of thing. They were just kind of like, he kind of hates where he is and he's ticked off about it, you know? Like,
and he walks through the neighborhood and all his old friends make fun of him.
Yeah.
And so you can clearly see that he's living a different life than they are, but he's kind of still cool with them. And then you have Frey who left the neighborhood and went and got her nursing degree.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's just not a clear picture of what's motivating Max or really anybody in a kind of way that drives the story.
Or anybody.
I mean, Batman's a great contrast. You clearly know what's driving him. Like, he wants justice and he wants
He's kind of an arrogant billionaire, but he wants to be the arrogant billionaire because he knows that he can do something with it.
Yeah.
You know, whereas Max is just kind of wants to save himself and we never get that selfless part of the selfishness.
He's kind of aimless. So is there a turning point where Max kind of gets purpose or gets motivation? Or
I think there's...
Does it happen accidentally at the end of the movie?
Well, there definitely is. I think the problem they made is he's reluctant about it. He's kind
of reluctant. What is the turning point that he's reluctant about?
I mean, just having this... He kind of, you know...
He's going to make that decision.
Yeah, to like, you know, take them up there despite how dangerous it is. And like, you know, I don't know.
So this one reviewer, this was the funniest thing that I read about this movie the whole time, and this was on Rotten Tomatoes, so it wasn't one of the links he sent us, but one of the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes said, "Do you know you've got trouble when the climax of your movie is a computer download?" The big moment is...
just the click of a key.
Like, when that's your climax, you're in trouble. So yeah, I would agree that it happens, that there is a moment of transformation when he realizes that he can save everybody, but it happens so late in the movie that
there's a kind of sense throughout the whole entire ending, even though he's kind of trying to be selfless, that he doesn't want to be selfless. Like, I wish I didn't have to do this.
Yeah, we still wonder at the very end if he's actually going to do it. He's still going to be, we're like, oh, is he going to make the decision? Seems like he should. Probably should. Yeah. Shouldn't be a jerk about it.
Well, and it does bookend with his statement in the orphanage, which it says he can't... Remember, it says... Here, meet Frey. She's new to the orphanage as well, which I think it probably implies that his parents just died and maybe her parents just died. But anyway, he tells her under the tent and the flashlight, I'm going to get you there one day. Mm-hmm. And so in the end of the movie, he fulfills that promise. He got her there. But even that was an accident. Like, he stepped on the spaceship and like, what the heck are you doing here? Yeah. Oh, well, I'll get you to release
Well, I guess since you're coming.
Yeah.
Well, how do you... I think one of the parallels that is a little more on the nose... When people are already going into this film going, this film's saying something, and we've already established that every film's saying something, but since people realize that, they're starting to look. And since they're starting to look, they're seeing one of the more typical type things, and that is Max as the Christ-like figure. So do you feel like Max works as a Christ-like figure? So we'll wrap, you know, we'll wrap with this, but
we're wrapping with this.
We're wrapping with this. well, before our moments and stuff.
Yeah, I don't think it works, and a couple of the reviewers pointed this out. So he uses violence to accomplish salvation, which Christ didn't do. Yeah. And I think he's incredibly confused about his motivation.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he ultimately...
Which Christ is not confused about his motivation. Exactly.
Yeah, I think he, you know, the failure of, like we keep saying, the failure of the film is that he totally doesn't really know what why he's doing things, and he's reluctant to do them. So, you know, I kind of balk at, you know, everybody wants to, when there's a sacrificial character, point it to Christ. And I just don't think that... that necessarily has to be the case, you know, but I mean, I understand the people want to throw it to that and parallel to that, but like nothing can ever be truly Christ-like, you know, Superman ain't Christ, you know, like he's just not, because ultimately we're selfish and we're, you know, going to have sin in our life. And, you know, I understand the like, but is he a Christ figure? Well, I think that's irrelevant.
Just because you sacrifice yourself?
Yeah, because you sacrifice yourself doesn't necessarily mean, you know.
Yeah, just because you accidentally find out you have a virus in your brain as soon as you have to download
it. What does Paul say, you know, he's like, who would you find that would sacrifice themselves for even one man, you know, one good, and maybe even one good man, but, you know, certainly not anybody else, you know, like...
So here's the way I think this movie does point to Christ, and it's actually a counterexample. Think by raising the question, or by raising the issue of the good life and the bad life, which, by the way, Elysium, you know where Elysium comes from?
It's heaven.
I want you to tell me.
It's the
Greek mythology. Greek mythology. The Elysian fields, Elysium.
It's Greek mythology heaven, yeah.
Yeah, it's the place that the gods would send the heroes after battle.
You're going to find that quote?
I'm going to find that quote. So
I would say by calling the movie Elysium, they are... unabashedly trying to tap into this idea of heaven or the good life or the place you want to go in your ideal reality. So here's how I think that points to Christ.
Oh, snap.
So we're in Matthew 5, that's a Sermon on the Mount.
Everyone, take out your Bibles. Go ahead and turn there. Yeah. We'll give you a second.
So this is the Beatitudes. This is how Jesus... interestingly defines the good life, very much in contrast to how Blomkamp defines the good life. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So Jesus defines the good life as people who live in faith and in relationship with the presence of God. So by showing mercy, you're trusting that there's, in some sense, somebody greater than you who will honor that show of mercy. Like, you're trusting that the world is not survival of the fittest, but the world is survival of those who show mercy, because God will show mercy to those who show mercy. So every one of these actions require doing something that in human terms gives no reward or gives no good life. So being a peacemaker, you're trusting that by not waging war, that waging war is how you would secure for yourself the good life, by taking what you want to take or defending what you want to defend. But by being a peacemaker, you're trusting that God, there is a God in heaven who honors the making of peace. So I think this film points to Christ in a counter way, a counterexample way of raising the question and then giving the wrong answer, which, in my opinion, the wrong answer, which raises the question, what is the right answer to the question, what is the good life?
Yeah, and I think the Christ example that I saw was Max not only sacrifices himself, so he's not just a Christ figure because he dies. There's lots of people die in movies all the time and they're not Christ figures, but it's that when he dies, he sacrifices himself so that all may become citizens of Elysium.
Yeah.
You know, so his one sacrifice allows all to come. I mean, which, like I said, this is just the devil's advocate kind of thing. Sure. Because I'm still with like him not being a very good Christ figure, because I think he ultimately brings people to what basically Elijah's saying, the wrong, you know, Mm-hmm. If Elysium's the goal, then you miss the point.
Well, right. And the problem with a political solution as the answer to the good life. So the political solution here was universal health care. Everybody gets a med bay and everybody gets healed. So the problem with that, and this is what Israel learned pretty quickly when they got the blueprint for the good life on Mount Sinai, which was the tabernacle, God's presence, and the law, the Ten Commandments. That was how they were supposed to go establish a new society with that, essentially, is what they were supposed to do. So the problem that they ran into pretty quickly is there can be no political solution to create the good life without a prior spiritual solution. Mm-hmm. So there's your med bay, but if you still have a corrupt heart, mm-hmm. you're still going to have warlords. You're still going to have...
The med bay is not going to fix greed.
Right, it's not going to fix greed. Yeah, it's not going to fix selfishness. This is interesting to contrast capitalism and socialism, if you want to go to the political angle. The problem with socialism is it basically advocates covetousness. And the problem with capitalism is it basically advocates selfishness. So each of them advocate two sins, essentially, to establish a political philosophy based on
how do you think of that in terms of a movie? I mean what can a movie do that's going to be anywhere near the right? Obviously I don't think you can have, unless you have a very blatant heaven and hell, maybe even telling the Christ story. You can't really have that accurate depiction, because ultimately when you make a film, there's hundreds of people who are involved in the process, writing the story, acting out the characters, whatever. You can't really have that. You can hint at it. That's why we have is he a Christ-like figure? He's not Christ, but does he have Christ-like parallels? Yeah, it's clunky in this movie, but everybody kind of, if you have that sacrificial character and you have a hero's journey, because we come from the meta narrative of scripture, the good versus evil, that, the overarching story of what the Bible tells is the meta narrative, that we talk about. You're obviously going to have that, but there's never going to be a movie that's going to have it exactly right, because... Yeah. And is that because no filmmaker can be perfect? Is it necessary for the story?
Yeah, I think it. I'll use a couple of big words. There's a phrase.
I'm excited.
Sweet, I'm going to write these down.
There's a phrase called overrealized eschatology and underrealized eschatology. So eschatology comes from the Greek word eschaton, which means last days. And so overrealized eschatology is essentially overpromising now what we hope to have in the last days, and under-realized eschatology is essentially under-promising now what we will have in the last days. So if you don't go far enough, you have under-realized eschatology. If you go too far, you have over-realized eschatology in the present. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it comes down to back to nuance. So a nuanced filmmaker can tell a story that's not over-promising or under-promising. Right. They can tell a story that raises your dreams, your aspirations, your hopes, and still feels somewhat realistic.
Like grounded or rooted.
Still feels grounded. Yeah. Yeah. And yet it's not, if it's such an under-promising film, then why should I even get excited about
it? Exactly, yeah.
So I think that's the key, is to be able to tell a story that gets as close as it can to realize eschatology without over-promising as, oh, this is ridiculous. This can't even be happening today.
Like Gladiator.
Well, there you go.
I found the quote. The quote from Gladiator, when Maximus is talking to the cavalry, he says, "Hold the line, stay with me, and if you find yourself alone riding in green fields with the sun on your face, do not be troubled, for you are in Elysium, and you are already dead." And that's when he says the classic line, "Brothers, what we do in life echoes in eternity."
Yeah.
That's nuanced.
Which would seem to maybe contradict his previous statement, but...
Yes, exactly.
But we could do Gladiator at some point, because it's ripe as well.
Yes,
and the best part of movies like that is they say things and people think they sound good without thinking about them, so they repeat them as if they were what they believe, but they actually proclaim something completely different. Mm-hmm. But we've run the gamut. Okay, we've talked about the overarching controversy. We've talked about the actual movie itself, the main character mainly, and his journey and how we didn't like it. So I want to quickly run through this last part so we can not let this one go quite as long as the last one.
Yeah.
So each of you, I need your, come on, moment, which there might be a lot of. So, like I said, this is the quick fire.
See previous conversation.
See the rest of it.
Yeah. The meerkat story, where the little girl tells the story of the meerkat and the hippo, annoyed the crap out of me because it was a very heavy-handed, knock you over the head, blatant parallel to the story of what was going to happen with Max and his character and her.
Why does the little girl even know? Why does she care? Why would she tell the story?
Yeah, like, she just happened to tell that story right then. And like, it was just a very, very, very clunky, obvious, you know, throw in to have some kind of thematic parallel. I have more if you'd like, but go ahead. You can have one.
So probably my biggest come-on moment was when Kruger's two friends roll him into the med bay and his face is completely blown off and they look in and say, oh, his brain is still working. And they roll him in and somehow he mysteriously comes back to life. But that was a little bit of a come on moment.
Well,
definitely.
As someone who spends a great deal of his time working in IT, I'm so tired of the upload timer. I just can't take when it's like, how long is it going to take? Race against time. Race against the upload. Is this USB 3.0? Oh, my gosh. Wire. I hope so. It needs to be faster. I'm so tired of, like, the countdown and the whole concept, like, the misunderstanding of technology and how it works. Because it bleeds into, like, the code as well. I'm like, so you're saying that you're the only person in the world that could have written this code. Not only are you the only person that written it, but if anyone else sees it who couldn't have written it, they can glance at it like it's the Matrix and they just understand it.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I'll just change this line right here. And suddenly, you know, there is no code, you know, that is written that's that complex, that is that simple.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so that was like almost like the Deus Ex Machina kind of annoyance. But I know that we can talk about come on moments forever. But now I'm going to make you really transition. Tell me your favorite part of this movie.
My favorite part of the movie was the visuals. I really like the robots. I love the world itself. I mean, even though it has its, you know, like we said, the entire conversation we've had, it's got its, you know, obviously like heavy handedness and like, you know, simplification of what's good and bad. But the visual and the kind of idea and the, you know, everything was portrayed. I mean, because, I mean, that's what they focused on most in this movie. And I thought it was really, really well done. And anytime we were kind of briefly immersed in that world, which is the gigantic failure of the movie, is we weren't immersed enough.
Mm-hmm.
But there was just, it had this really kind of cool feel, cool sci-fi, you know, dystopian type of feel to it that I really enjoyed.
I'd have to say my favorite thing about the movie was really just that it was a think piece, I think, and unapologetically so. So I admire that about them, that they were, I think the Kruger character, when he was interviewed by the New York Times, was right. Like, we're not going down the middle. We're, that creates weakness. Yeah. We're going hard one side or the other. So that would be my big picture thought. Practically, specific scene-wise, I kind of like the scene where Kruger was on top of his roof barbecuing with a sword.
Yeah, that was cool.
There's just something about him being above the people, him making fun of him, and then he gets the message on his watch or whatever that he's been discharged, and then he throws the whole barbecue pit down below.
I really enjoyed Kruger as a character.
He was good.
You know, even though he just got to be this kind of like loony, zany version of what he could have been.
Yeah.
You know.
I agree.
But he was good at it.
Yeah, he was really good at it. I mean, he just kicked butt the whole time.
In contrast, his character to the role he played in District 9, where he's kind of this wuss, as I recall. Yeah. It was kind of like sissified, like not very...
He's a really great actor. He's kind of an
underrated actor. Yeah. You saw the A-Team, right?
No, I didn't see A-Team.
Oh, the A-Team's great.
He's on the A-Team?
I have it on Blu-ray over there.
Yeah. Okay.
It's
A-Team's fantastic. He's really good
at it. And he's really good at it.
I need to get that then.
He's Murdoch, whatever. So my favorite moment, I guess we all just hit on accidentally, because my favorite thing in the movie was Kruger's character. I thought it was the only character I was interested in.
Oh, wow.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, like, I hated his character. Uh-huh. I hated every action that his character did.
Yeah.
But, like, he was the only character to me that had clear motivation, and I was on board with what he was doing.
That's good. And you just reminded me that was a huge Superman parallel, too. The military taking over the ideal world, going into the political room and throwing the bomb. I mean, that was total Captain Zod or General Zod going in and taking over.
Oh, yeah.
And his whole motivation for attacking Max when he had the grenade was to take what was in his head. So on the spaceship, what started the fight was I want what's in your head, and Matt mm-hmm. Damon kind of went berserk.
That's when he started fighting.
That's when he started fighting.
He didn't plan to.
So yeah. It was the military trying to take over mm-hmm. the political reality in order to have it for themselves or for their own purposes.
And there was an argument that I had with another person who said that Kruger was still a two-dimensional character. And I actually think he was one of the few three-dimensional characters. I think a two-dimensional character is a henchman. Mm-hmm. I think the two guys that were with Kruger were two-dimensional characters. Yeah. We don't know anything about them. They just are there to do this thing, to be henchmen. Mm-hmm. But Kruger starts out as like he's a maverick.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. and then he's like, yeah, I've got my own aspirations. You know, I think I'm going to be in charge now. Mm-hmm. And he takes a turn and actually develops by becoming more crazy.
Right,
but he still is. He's on it. He's on his own journey, and it's the only journey that like I could actually follow.
But I agree. It seems pretty likely that there is a prior relationship between Kruger and Neil Blomkamp, such that since they've acted.
Oh, you mean Charlotte Copley, the actor?
Yeah, the director and Kruger, the actor who played Kruger. So I wonder how much that played into
there's definitely a relationship.
Kruger's. Oh,
yeah. Charlotte Copley was not an actor, and he just kind of was a. guy that knew Neil Blomkamp when he made District 9, and they were friends. He was like, "You want to act in my movie?" He's like, "Yeah, I'll do that."
Huh,
so now he's a famous actor. So
I wonder if that allowed him to have more of a hands-on ownership of his character
in
Elysium, whereas somebody like Matt Damon coming in who didn't know him.
Well, I thought Matt Damon did a great job with what he was given.
Yeah,
I really did.
I can see that.
The part was originally going to go to Eminem.
I read that was hilarious.
So it would not have probably even worse. Done a good job.
So
even
worse. You're saying this is like the Liam Neeson, Natalie Portman in the first couple Star Wars movies thing again.
Yeah.
You did good with what you had.
Yeah, but you didn't
your character didn't make any sense, and your script didn't make any sense.
Can't overcome a bad script.
Well. We have done the best we can with the time I think we have. There's lots more that we could dive into. I mean, there's lots of meta-narrative stuff and God in the story type things that we didn't even hit on. But the whole goal, continue to have conversations outside this podcast. Continue to like talk to with your friends. Don't just write a movie off because someone told you it's about something. If it's worth talking about, then maybe it's worth seeing. So not necessarily in a theater. I'm not, you know, everyone doesn't need to necessarily go and see every single movie in the theater. It's a financial commitment, but you know, there's a lot more there than just turning your brain off, obviously.
Exactly.
So I want to thank my guests and give them a chance to kind of pimp themselves. So,
can I choose a different word?
Yeah. Oh wait. Yeah. I guess if Elijah pimps himself, that would kind of be job endangerment there.
Yeah.
Elijah is definitely not pimping himself in any way.
Promote. We're going to promote ourselves.
Yeah. So, Elijah, if people have loved just hearing your interactions, how can they follow what you're doing or interact with you?
I'm an executive and community pastor at Church of the Redeemer, so you can come visit us at Burmill Country Club, our clubhouse where we meet on Sunday mornings. I preach there from time to time, also lead Bible studies or participate in a community group. So those are all ways that you can visit. You can email me at Elijah@RedeemerGSO.org if you would like.
And actually, I'm going to give you the link to my videos. Did you put it on the notes of the last podcast I was on?
You shouldn't have to ask me because I know you're going there and checking.
I'm totally
sure
going there and checking. But I've got a couple short films I've done. I mean, being a writer that I am, you know, I kind of stay in the background until something comes out that I've done. So I'm constantly writing, but you know, I've got a couple short films out that we'll link at the site again, and you know, just check me out on Facebook if you want to get in touch with me and have any stories you want me to write for you. That'd be great too.
Especially paid.
That's right.
You want to pay me to write a story?
And if you're an NFL fan, we do have our LetPylonsBePylons.com, which is our where you can find Fizz and I's other podcast where we talk about football all week or all year, all season.
All year.
Yeah.
We're in it for the long haul.
We are.
Well, thank you guys once again. And if you want to interact with me, Fizz, let me know of movies you'd love to hear us discuss on the show, then feel free to follow me on the Twitter.
The Twitter,
because I'm old now. So I put the definite article in front, the Facebook, the Twitter, the social medias. You can follow me at Fizzification. You can also find us at our blog, realworldtheology.com. Like us on Facebook, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you like the show, leave us a review so we can get more people in on the conversation. Again, I just want to thank my guests for being here and you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. So until next episode, while you're watching, listening, and engaging, remember, entertainment is not mindless. Bye.